Dr. Newell Bringhurst is going to be addressing us today, who teaches history and political science at the College at the Sequoias in Visalia, California. And he's a very active writer and publisher and scholar in Mormon letters and history, has written two books of interest here, Saints, Slaves, and Blacks, The Changing Place of Mormonism, of Blacks in Mormonism, in 1981, and Brigham Young and the Expanding American Frontier in 1986. He's been published in Sunstone Dialogue, the Journal of Mormon History, a number of other scholarly publications, doing extensive work and scholarship on Mormon history, Mormon sources, Mormon culture, and the perception of Mormons in culture. He's currently at work on a biography on Fawn Brody, one of Joseph Smith's biographers, and his paper today will grow out of the work that he's doing on Fawn Brody. The respondent, Levina Fielding Anderson, who is one of the primary participants here, who we're all going to go and listen to at the luncheon and be seriously edified by, is an editor who edits the proceedings for the Association for Mormon Letters, who is on the staff of the Mormon Women's Forum, edits the Journal of Mormon History, and many, many other things. The list is far too long to read here, but they are impressive credentials indeed. I'm impressed. So, again, let's get started with the program, and to remind everybody who came in late, you can buy this stuff on tape.
Excuse me, did you write that review?
No. He's Italian fellow Massimo Interbegne, and I'll be commenting on that. So you're going to get a different version than he gave you. I can guarantee that. This is my eighth Sunstone Symposium. I've been very fortunate. I don't know how many people in the audience have been to all eight of them. I've attended all eight of the Sunstone Symposiums, and I've also been very fortunate to be able to participate in all eight. In all of those eight, I've discussed Mormon dissidents, various Mormon dissidents. That seems to be a topic of mine. I've come through Fawn Brody three times, Sam Brannan once. Commented on a paper by Sam Taylor on Annie Scarron, I guess that was her name, and Annalisa, yeah. And today I'm going to talk about still another dissident, Deborah Lake, and maybe drawing some comparisons with Fawn Brody. It's appropriate that I would comment on these two female dissidents and have the commentary by Levina, herself also a female dissident. It kind of provides a certain symmetry here. It'll be interesting to see how that symmetry works out in the comments that she has henceforth. So here goes. In April 1993, William Morrow and Company published Deborah Lake's Secret Ceremonies, a Mormon woman's intimate diary of marriage and beyond. This work was destined to attract widespread attention by virtue of its popularity, appearing on the New York Times bestseller list for a total of 13 weeks. It also generated widespread controversy both within and outside of the Mormon Church. The author, Deborah Lake, a lapsed Mormon, found herself immediately condemned by Latter-day Saint officials, both in Salt Lake City and in Phoenix, Arizona, where she lived. On April 25th, within days of the publication of Secret Ceremonies, a church court was held in Phoenix, and Lake was formally excommunicated from the Mormon Church. She was charged with apostasy and for, quote, putting church doctrines and teachings to open shame and public ridicule. Mormon leaders in Salt Lake City also reacted through spokesman Don LeFevre, asserting that Secret Ceremonies, quote, does not represent the personal and religious experiences of members of the Mormon Church, unquote. LeFevre also rejected Lake's central assertion that her experiences within the church were largely responsible for her own acute marital difficulties, in particular, three failed marriages as well as serious psychological problems. According to LeFevre, quote, Lake's experiences were atypical of Mormon marriages. In even more sweeping terms, Elaine Jack, LDS Relief Society president, wrote, quote, the perspective of Secret Ceremonies is not at all representative of Mormon women everywhere, unquote. Outside of official Mormondom, and indeed outside of the church, condemnation of Deborah Lake and her books were also strong. Writing for Newsweek, non-Mormon critics Kenneth Woodward and Jean Gordon labeled Lake's, quote, self-pitying volume a pray-and-tell book that mocks Mormon ritual. More recently, Massimo Intervegni, a Roman Catholic scholar and director for the Center for Studies of New Religions in Torino, Italy, wrote an extremely critical review of secret ceremonies for the December 1993 issue of Sunstone, which obviously some of you have seen, wherein he dismisses secret ceremonies as, quote, little more than a garden variety expose. Similarly, a third non-Mormon writer, Jan Shipps, professor of religious studies at Indiana Purdue University, Indianapolis, condemned Lake's work in even stronger terms. In an unpublished letter circulated among certain select scholars, including, I think you received a copy of that, didn't you, Levina? Shipps asserted that Lake's, quote, scornful description of the temple ordinances was a calculated tactic designed to make the book appeal to the fundamentalists and evangelical Christians who are forever seeking evidence to use in their charge that Mormonism is nothing but a cult, unquote. From this standpoint, Shipps further asserted that, quote, Lake's book is not just trashing Mormonism, it is trashing religion generally. Shipps also attacked Lake's work as, quote, counterproductive rather than helpful as far as most Mormon feminists are concerned. In light of such universal condemnation, one might justifiably ask, why another look at Deborah Lake and her secret ceremonies? But in fact, I maintain that a careful reexamination of both Deborah Lake and her controversial work is not without socially redeeming value, notwithstanding Massimo Intervegne's suggestion that this volume is little more than mild pornography. Indeed, Lake's volume provides significant insights into the situation of women within contemporary Mormonism. Even critic Jan Shipps suggests the value of Lake's volume in this regard. The first several chapters of Lake's work, note Shipps, quote, are quite effective in capturing the way BYU was functioning as the Mormon marriage market when the author was there during the early 1970s. Shipps also concedes that, quote, there is little doubt about what Lake says about Mormon females being programmed for domestic life and given to believe that it is their only option. Lake is absolutely right, continues Shipps, in noting that LDS priesthood holders at every level glorify wives and mothers to such a degree that all other female roles are denigrated as somehow unworthy, un-Mormon, unquote. Indeed, a significant portion of secret ceremonies focuses on Deborah Lake's personal struggle to secure fulfillment as a housewife. More significant, however, is Lake's frank and revealing discussion of her personal search for self-identity, a search that led to severe emotional trauma as it brought her into conflict with her own strongly held Mormon beliefs. This struggle, which undermined and ultimately destroyed Lake's Mormon faith, might seem improbable given the author's background and upbringing. Deborah Lake was born on the 19th of April, 1952, into a Mormon family of strong faith and conviction. She grew up in the small central Florida town of Longo, near St. Petersburg. Deborah's maternal grandmother, Thelma Baker, had joined the Mormon Church as a young teenager in the early 20th century and was reportedly the first Mormon ever to live in central Florida. A woman of strong convictions, she in turn managed to convert her husband to Mormonism. In turn, their son, Deborah's father, came of age and married a Methodist girl whom he persuaded to become a Latter-day Saint. He was strong in his Mormon beliefs, which led to his calling as bishop of his small Florida ward. His deeply held beliefs impressed themselves upon daughter Deborah, who recalled their most vivid manifestation in what she described as the primary legend of her family. According to this legend, the elder Lake, as a young man, had worried about earning a living. So he retired to the local Mormon chapel to pray and meditate. There he received a revelation. And all these years later, Deborah was able to recite the text as if it were canonized scripture. Quote, "I will take thee by the hand and lead thee into a new land. Thou wilt prosper, for I am with thee. Who will stand against thee?" Unquote. Subsequently, Lake's father moved with his family to Arizona, where he achieved great success. According to Deborah, quote, "This story was the basis of our family life, which in turn generated a feeling of being protected and a special, protected and special, and a family of whom God approved." Such strong religious convictions impressed themselves upon young Deborah. As a child, she recalled being blessed by her father or brothers on, quote, "those occasions when I had been ill or very troubled and had needed a powerful priesthood advocate of God," unquote. "My childhood and adolescence were consumed by an overwhelming swell of testimony," she remembered. According to her mother, Deborah would stand up in church and bear some of the sweetest testimonies, with her mother adding, "she was just a ray of sunshine." Deborah was also extremely bright, doing very well in school. As she neared graduation from high school, Deborah was told by her high school counselor that the high results on her college entrance exams would guarantee her admission to many of the best universities in America. But she had long since made up her mind, telling her counselor, quote, "I am a Mormon. I am going to Brigham Young University," unquote. Deborah arrived at Brigham Young in the fall of 1970 with one major goal in mind, marriage. As she recalled, quote, "the traditions of my religion had mainly taught me to be concerned with my suitability for wifehood," unquote. And BYU was certainly the place to focus on this objective. But the young BYU freshman soon encountered unexpected difficulties in pursuing this goal. Deborah lamented that she, quote, "was always ignored by the young men I knew who struck me as being close to God," unquote. She tried to figure out why, her own deeply held religious beliefs notwithstanding. The only conclusion she could come to was, quote, "I didn't show up well spiritually." She blamed this on her outgoing, extroverted personality, combined with her somewhat carefree attitudes. In addition, she was tall, 5'10" in height. All of these attributes, combined with her extreme intelligence, caused Deborah to stand out from most other BYU co-eds. Thus, Deborah was thrilled when her Sunday school teacher, a 21-year-old returned missionary whom she's dubbed, I don't know if this is his real name, she changes names throughout the book, Robert Peck. I was going to ask Jean about, I don't think so, but took an interest in her and they began to date. Stiff, solemn, and generally reserved in his demeanor, Robert Peck stood in sharp contrast to the effervescent, outgoing Deborah. But she was attracted by his serious, sober, strongly held spirituality. "My life is about living close to God," the earnest young man told Deborah on one occasion. Awed by Robert Peck's strong religious convictions, Deborah later recalled, quote, "what a prig he was. I loved him completely," unquote. But his feelings toward Deborah were ambivalent. As Deborah later recalled, he remarked, quote, "Deborah, sometimes I don't think that you're spiritual enough for me," unquote. By the time that Deborah had finished her freshman year in the spring of 1971, their relationship was clearly on the wane. He left Provo for the summer while she remained on campus, but they maintain contact through letters. In one such letter, Robert Peck, well aware of Deborah's intelligence and talents as a writer, for by this time she was editor on the school newspaper, urged Deborah to pursue her education, even encouraging her to consider graduate school. Such advice, however, offended rather than pleased Lake, causing her to lament that his letters, quote, were very discouraging since they had only to do with my mind, adding that I suspected he had quit thinking about my body altogether, unquote. By the fall of 1971, their relationship had ended. Deborah's failed romance did not lessen her desire to find a suitable mate and marry. Indeed, as she later confessed, quote, my urgency to marry increased considerably. I was very eager to get married before it was too late. She feared finding herself in the situation of her roommate, who at age 21 and still unmarried was considered an old maid. By December of 1971, she had met and was seriously dating Monty Brown, a roommate to her older brother Len, also a student at BYU. What basically drew the uncoupled together was Monty's strong interest in Deborah. Quote, I was a pushover for a man who truly wanted me, unquote, in the wake of a rejection by Robert Peck. In addition, Monty, despite being much shorter than Deborah, was very handsome with a square face and a remarkably strong jaw. He was, moreover, a stylish dresser and a preppy ballroom dancer. In early spring 1972, Monty asked Deborah to marry her, and she accepted, even though she admitted to not loving him. As the date for the young couple's wedding approached, however, Deborah experienced strong doubts and, in turn, her first crisis of faith as she sought divine guidance concerning her difficult situation. Her prayers were agonized as she found herself railing at God over the unhappy prospect of living with Monty. She later recalled, quote, I was trying to know the right thing to do, unquote. Monty, however, had no such doubts. When she told Monty of her own doubts and negative feelings, her future husband convinced her that they were the work of Satan, who was, quote, trying to interfere with what the Lord wants us to do, unquote. Deborah believed him because he was, quote, he was a Mormon priesthood holder possessing divine authority. Quote, I looked to Monty as my spiritual protector and tried to love him, unquote. And so, in June of 1972, Deborah and Monty were married in the Mesa Temple, Mesa, Arizona Temple. The doubts that Deborah had concerning Monty were compounded by the disillusionment she experienced in going through the temple, all of which she describes in full and graphic detail in the pages of Secret Ceremonies. In the wake of her own temple experience, Lake remarked, quote, it wasn't what I thought it would be. I expected to hear things that would make me feel inside the way I feel when I'm singing the hymns I love best, unquote. Additional disappointment came as a result of her first sexual experience with Monty following their wedding. She lamented that, quote, his cruelty, unquote, in blaming her entirely for their sexual failure shattered the little frail intimacy that the couple had developed as a result of that experience. Such deep concerns notwithstanding, Deborah tried to make her marriage work following their move to Salt Lake City, where they lived while Monty attended the University of Utah. Quote, I tried to nurture my marriage, she recalled, by developing a network of advisors that included her brother, Len, who was still living down in Provo while attending BYU, her ward bishop, as well as a professional psychiatrist, also a Mormon. Quote, I desperately wanted someone to teach me how to be happily married. Deborah, however, had difficulty communicating her feelings to any of these three individuals, and she began to experience severe emotional problems. In fact, the only suggestion that Deborah followed was advice given by her psychiatrist concerning her sexuality. This involved masturbation, which was suggested to facilitate improvement in her sexual relations with Monty. To Deborah, this advice was like a bombshell, because it came from this Mormon psychiatrist whom she considered a man of God, unquote, and ran counter to prevailing church taboos relative to this practice. But she heeded her psychiatrist's advice, describing her experiences as an awakening, stating, quote, "I discovered my body and my sexuality for the first time." Such self-gratification, however, offered only a temporary escape from her deep-seated marital and emotional problems, and Deborah's mental condition continued to deteriorate. Just months into her marriage, she found life with Monty increasingly intolerable, but saw herself in an impossible dilemma, having taken to heart the current statements of top Mormon leaders made in reaction to a general increase in divorce during the late 1960s and early 1970s. She was particularly struck by the admonitions of late President David O. McKay, who had stated, quote, "No other success can compensate for failure in the home. Any woman who will break up her home because of some selfish desire is also untrue to the covenant she has made in the house of the Lord," unquote. By early 1973, Deborah had reached such a point of despair and depression that she attempted suicide, at which point her father stepped in. He, in the words of Deborah, found, quote, "a jet-propelled lawyer who forced the divorce through in a mere 2 weeks," unquote. One finalized on the 14th of February, 1973, which ironically enough was Valentine's Day. She had been married just 8 months. Deborah's divorce did not end her problems, however. She returned to Florida to live with her parents, attempting to resume life as she had left it before her marriage and departure to Brigham Young University some 3 years earlier. She remained an active practicing Latter-day Saint, attending services at her old ward, but as a divorcee, she felt herself unique and isolated from other female members of the ward. In the fall of 1973, Deborah moved to Phoenix, Arizona, in part to resume her education at Arizona State University at Tempe, but also to seek comfort in an environment where, in her own words, she was, quote, "completely unknown and would not be compared to the young woman I had been before I had been married," unquote. She remained active in the church, attending her local ward and pursuing her major objective of regaining her temple recommend, which had been withdrawn in the wake of her divorce, a standard procedure in the church at the time. She saw re-entry into the temple as a necessary first step towards the ultimate goal of freeing herself completely from Monty through a temple divorce. Quote, "As far as the church was concerned," she explained, "my civil divorce counted only until death," at which time she believed that her temple marriage to Monty would kick into effect. In the meantime, Deborah met and began to seriously date Lowell Bateman, a mechanical engineer, divorced and some 20 years older and a non-Mormon. Deborah was drawn to Lowell by his wit and sense of humor and by, quote, "his fabulous tallness, a height so extreme that I came barely past his shoulder," unquote. He was also very intelligent and, most important, according to Deborah, quote, "he loved me with a devotion that never abated." Ultimately, Deborah agreed to marriage, even though she confessed to not really loving the man. I wanted terribly to belong to someone, she admitted, not having the slightest idea how to relate to any man except as marriage material, unquote. Thus, this marriage, like her first, was doomed to failure. Her situation was further exacerbated by difficulties experienced with certain aspects of her Mormonism. She was uncomfortable that she was the only married woman in her ward without a husband who attended services, feeling that her household was impotent because her non-Mormon husband did not possess the priesthood with its divine authority. Such concerns led her into a clandestine affair with a former boyfriend, a Latter-day Saint whom she had dated before meeting Lowell. She justified this relationship on the grounds that she needed, quote, "some time with a man with a religious heart who shared my beliefs." Deborah also stopped wearing her temple garments in the wake of her marriage to Lowell. She graphically notes her mixed feelings at the moment she stopped wearing them. Quote, "My heart and loins pulsed with a thrill of danger that was almost sexual. But I also felt utterly helpless and unprotected, as though I were a soft, stripped sapling, an inch thick that could be snapped in two by someone's hands. That feeling of vulnerability would last for years." Unquote. Indeed, such vulnerability was nowhere more evident than in Deborah's reaction to the rage expressed by her husband Lowell when he found out about her clandestine affair. In turn, she succumbed to a depression deeper than that experienced at the time of the breakup of her first marriage. Ultimately, Deborah was committed to a local psychiatric facility where she received treatment with antidepressant drugs and counseling. This traumatic experience also ended her second marriage. Deborah recovered and managed to complete her studies at Arizona State University. In the late 1970s, she moved to Salt Lake City, where she took a position with Utah Holiday, a small city magazine known for its willingness to treat Utah sacred cows, including the church, with near objectivity. As for her Mormonism, Deborah admitted to becoming less and less of a Mormon, but she described her move back to Salt Lake and into the Mormon religion's heart as a final convulsion of trying to hold on, but admitted that it didn't work in that I didn't rededicate myself to the church. I had lost faith, but there was still ambivalence. She continued, quote, to slip into church a couple of times a month and flip through the Book of Mormon occasionally, hoping for instructions that still seemed relevant and was still praying. But, she added, I wasn't a part of it. I simply hadn't let go entirely. Meanwhile, Deborah floated exhaustedly into a society of Jack Mormons because, as she said, quote, it required so much less of me, unquote. While in Utah, she became involved in a long-term relationship with Adam. I guess this is another pseudonym. A non-Mormon with whom she lived off and on for the next several years. They never married. In this case, Deborah was more attracted to him, apparently, than he was to her. In fact, Deborah asked him to marry her, an offer which he declined. Their intimate relationship came to a gradual but difficult end after Deborah received a fellowship to attend graduate school at Northwestern University. But Deborah experienced one more emotional breakdown while living in Washington, D.C., fulfilling an internship with Northwestern University News Service based in that city. She underwent treatment at the Psychiatric Institute in downtown Washington, D.C. for a period of 8 weeks, where she managed to recover. After completing her studies, she returned to Phoenix, Arizona, where she assumed a position as writer and editor for the New Times, an alternate weekly news magazine chronicling crime and politics. At present, she is executive managing editor of that publication. In general, what is most striking about Deborah Lake's experiences as described in Secret Ceremonies is that they are the frank, vivid odyssey about a bright, articulate woman who, as a Latter-day Saint, did not fit the stereotypical image of what's usually thought of as a typical Mormon woman, who struggled to come to terms with her Mormonism. Hers was a struggle that, in the end, culminated in disaffection and abandonment of Mormon faith. More important, however, is that Deborah Lake's story is far from unique. Indeed, in certain respects, Lake's odyssey is strikingly similar to that of Fawn McKay Brody, the author of No Man Knows My History, the controversial biography of Joseph Smith, who was also excommunicated from the Mormon Church. Brody, like Lake, grew up in a small town and stood out from her contemporaries, both in intellect and physical stature. Extremely intelligent, Brody, as a youngster, was an outstanding student, skipping 3 grades by the time she graduated from high school at age 14. Brody, like Lake, was tall, standing 5 foot 10 inches tall, precisely the same height as Lake. Both women had fathers who served as church leaders during the years that each was growing up. Whereas Lake's father was a bishop, Vaughn's father, Thomas E. McKay, served for many years as president of the Ogden Stake and then went on to become an assistant to the Council of Twelve. Equally significant, Brody manifested strongly held religious beliefs during her formative years in a manner similar to that of Lake. Fawn, during her adolescent years, according to Brother Thomas, got up in a particular fast and testimony meeting and bore a beautiful testimony. In addition, both women exhibited strong obedience and respect for authority, be it parental, ecclesiastical, or secular. Fawn Brody recalled being, quote, a supremely good and obedient child, a model child, who never indulged in a healthy amount of mischief, unquote. Similarly, Deborah Lake, through sacred ceremonies, vividly describes her own unquestioning obedience as an adolescent, coming of age during the turbulent decade of the 1960s, whereby she stood out in sharp contrast to many of her contemporaries. Most significantly, both women found an outlet in writing for their creative energies and inner frustrations. Moving beyond the comparisons and similarities between Deborah Lake and Fawn Brody, I would also suggest that in critical respects, that critical aspects of Lake's difficult odyssey also bear a striking resemblance to those of other Latter-day Saint women as well. Lake herself insists that, quote, she had heard from over 200 Mormon women suffering from similar psychological and physical trauma. Corroborating evidence for Lake's observation has been provided by Martha Beck in a doctoral thesis written at Harvard. Beck conducted a case study of some 300 Mormon women who were examined relative to mutually exclusive demands of needing and wanting to work and church pressures to remain in the home, fulfilling the traditional role of housewife and mother. Beck found that a significant number of these women were torn and falling apart psychologically, attempting to make these two mutually exclusive ends come together so that God would love them. Thus, Deborah Lake's situation is clearly not unique. The official disclaimers of Don Lefebvre, Elaine Jack, and others notwithstanding. In conclusion, I personally feel that Deborah Lake's Secret Ceremonies is a significant work, worthy of further analysis. Such analysis will, hopefully, raise the level of discussion above that evident in the generally superficial polemical reviews of Lake's book that have appeared thus far. Thank you.
How many of you have read Secret Ceremonies? Okay, that's helpful to know, since Newell's sympathetic and intelligent summary of the book, I think, gives a very fair picture of its main themes and points. I've never met Deborah Lake. She contacted me a year ago last summer and asked for an early draft of the dialogue article on intellectuals in the church, which I was happy to provide her with, and I was sorry to hear about her excommunication last April. I noticed from the conjunction of dates that she was excommunicated just 6 days after her birthday, and that may be relevant. I saw some of the talk shows on which she appeared, the Phil Donahue Show and Larry King Live particularly. And if any of you saw that, I think that what struck me was that she was consistent and centered in not attacking the church, but in saying that she had written her book as an expression of her own experience. And that was also the position of the church spokespeople, that this was a personal experience. Obviously, it had been a bad experience. Why did she feel she needed to blame the church for it? I think that that's a valid objection to the book on one level. But the people who defended the church, for the most part, did it in with such vigor and even in some cases such venom that it was obvious that they weren't just merely disagreeing with Deborah Lake. And after I watched the Larry King live show where Beverly Campbell interrupted Deborah Lake perhaps 24 times in 12 minutes, interrupted Larry himself, shifted the grounds of the argument from the treatment of women in the church to how quickly the church was growing all around the world, admitted that women are not involved in decision making, do not hold the priesthood, cannot hold ecclesiastical office beyond a certain level, and Larry King stopped her at that point and said, let me get this straight and summarize this, and said, but women aren't discriminated against in Mormonism. And she paused for maybe a quarter of a second and said, well, it works for me. I thought at the end of that program, if I had to choose between which of the people I would go to lunch with, I would go with the woman I could have a conversation with, and that would not be Beverly Campbell. And so I would have to cast myself as a sympathetic reader of Deborah Lake's book, in spite of the fact that many parts of it made me uncomfortable. One of the things that you learned today is something that's not in the book, and that is that foundational family myth of Deborah Lake's parents, of feeling personally led by the Lord from their home in the East to Arizona, and feeling that they had a mission to do there and that the Lord would take care of them. That's a powerful myth to grow up inside of. And I think it's clear from what Deborah says that she accepted that myth as her personal story, as the outline of her personal life. Another contribution of Lowell's paper, and unfortunately he skipped over about 4 pages of it, was the parallels with Fawn Brody, and I hope that those will be fleshed out in another setting. But in my commentary, I'd like to focus on 3 issues that I think may explain why I feel that the book should, why I agree with Newell that the book should be read more sympathetically than it usually is. I think it's quite obviously a narrative of identity. The book is constructed in 2 obvious narrative layers. One is Deborah Lake, the writer, who is looking back with sympathy but with quite a bit of objectivity and a certain amount of wicked wit at this incredible twit of a child who went to BYU. And her portrait of herself is at least as merciless as her portrait of BYU and some of the men that she dated. Now, to do that means that there is a writerly distance between who Deborah Lake is when she's acting as the writer and who this Deborah Lake was that she is telling us about. But the very existence of the 2 layers means that there is a 3rd layer, that there is a 3rd narrative voice, and that is the one that constructs both the writerly voice and the young Deborah Lake voice. And I think that that 3rd layer, that 3rd voice, that 3rd narrator, is the one that deserves more attention than it has received in any setting up to this point that I have seen. And partly that's because the book takes the form of the traditional anti-Mormon expose. Massimo Introvigna, who is something of a specialist on anti-Mormon literature, has been, I think, fair and correct in pointing that out. It's much better written than most exposés, but it still is an exposé. The second point is that Deborah Lake focuses on her sexual confusion and her sexual hunger, and she does it in a way that we have no mechanisms for acknowledging very well in the church. Everybody in the church suppresses their sexuality, rechannels it into acceptable, socially acceptable formats. Sexual power gets manifest as ecclesiastical power. I think that the sexual passages are shocking and sometimes distasteful to read, but maybe when the first shock is over and people are able to read through those passages again and say, why did Deborah Lake have no way of processing her sexual feelings and sexual identity that was separate from her spiritual feelings and her spiritual identity? If there had been some way to bring those together, would there have been a different resolution to the story? I think that the desperation of her attempts to role-play the acceptable models, even to the point of saying, this person whom I do not love, but who is able to give me orgasms even before we have had intercourse, must be speaking in the voice of God when he says that the part of me that doesn't want to marry him must be the devil. Now, that is a very complicated theological concept. And and the fact is that it's the sexual activity that gets all of the attention and not the identity issue that's working itself out. The third question that I want to bring up is that of the temple ceremonies and how she dealt with the temple ceremonies. Newell points out in one of his footnotes, which he didn't have the benefit of reading, that the temple ceremony material covers a minuscule part of the total book. It was 19 pages, 17?
Yeah, I think it was even less than, out of
a book of more than 200 pages. Nearly everyone agrees that exposure of the temple ceremony performs no essential narrative function in the book. If she'd never gone to the temple, if a temple ceremony didn't exist in Mormonism, would it have really made that much difference in how the book turned out? And I think that I think that there's no question about the importance of the role that it plays in her life, but anything that had that much religious significance would have done the same thing. Now, Deborah Lake could not have been excommunicated for revealing the temple ceremony. In the first place, she got some important details wrong. In the second place, the temple ceremony has been widely available in its complete form for over 100 years, in print, available to anybody who wants it. I don't agree with, support, or like her decision to break her promise to keep it secret. I think that promises should be kept. But I want to ask why she felt it was necessary. And this is pure speculation on my part. I have no reason to believe that my interpretation is any better than anybody else's. But I think of the statement by Brigham Young that the signs and the tokens prepare us to walk by the angels and the gods and to take our place with God the Father. Now, if you think in terms of the mythic journey of the return to God, and you think of walking by the angels and the gods, they are there as protectors, as gatekeepers, as guardians of the path. That gives them not just a hostessly welcoming function, but also a protective and perhaps even a dangerous function. I think that at the core of any religious experience, there is a holy of holies. For Mormonism, I think that that resides in the temple, both literally as a room and figuratively as ultimate sanctity. And I think that because of Deborah Lake's combination of personal issues that she was working with, she had to open that door. She had to walk by the angels and the gods and open the door to what became, I think, for her, a chamber of horrors, and to find out that maybe they were just statues, or maybe they weren't there at all. I wish there had been some other way she could have done that, but I also feel some sympathy for her quest to do that. I think a more important result of that is that when you break a covenant, you're breaking faith with something. The question in Deborah Lake's case was she just breaking her covenant with a community to keep a vow of secrecy, or was she breaking a covenant with God, in which case the psychic shattering that she recounts that went through the successive mental breakdowns that she had makes perfect sense, I think, from a psychological point of view. My concern is for the third narrator, the Deborah Lake who constructed the young Deborah Lake and who constructed the writerly Deborah Lake. you can't dissolve covenants without replacing them with something else. And I hope that in her life she will be able to do that. But I think for our discussion in the time that remains, there are a lot of places this could go, especially for those of you who have read it. Is it in fact true that Deborah Lake's case is not a unique one? Or is it unique in that she has chosen to work it out in a public way, in a public forum that has brought the church into shame and ridicule, but that has released her in some ways to go on? And then there's the underlying question. I don't imagine very many of us would agree that the way Deborah Lake talked about her relationship to Mormonism is the way we enjoy talking about our relationship to Mormonism, or that we would agree with, or that we would want to do ourselves. But given that, then, how should we talk about our own religious experience? And Sunstones are always wonderful places to explore those questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. That was a very productive discussion. And in the time that remains, no time remains. And I want just to announce the guilt that I feel as a male sort.
Do we have 5 minutes?
Do we have 5 minutes?
Yeah.
They told me to be out.
Yeah.
Have 5 minutes?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
We will take. I don't feel guilty anymore. I'm not going to silence discussion for 5 minutes. So go. Go. Talk. Could overthrow me, right? Questions. 5 minutes of questions we have.
Well, I have to confess, I've never been through the temple. I'm not one of those that has been through that experience. So I'm really not qualified to describe that on a first person basis. But I've talked to a number of very good friends who have said that it's much different than what they've expected, and I think that there's a lot of that that goes on. It seems like, without betraying the secrets of the temple ceremony, I think it would be an interesting study. This was suggested to me when I was writing over to the symposium this morning, a study of how people have reacted and responded to the temple ceremonies. It could be done in good taste. It seems like that would be an area of discussion that I don't think would violate the spirit of what the temple ceremony means to devout Latter-day Saints. I don't know. But what you say, I don't feel like Deborah Lake's experience is all that atypical, because I've heard it from a number of other people. Yes. To respond to what you say, I detect from what I've been following what the church is doing, I think in that area the church has been trying to make adjustments in responding and dealing with the situation of divorced people in the church. I'm not in that status, but I can't speak on that either. but I notice the shaking of heads. There seems to be more of an acknowledgement that there is a problem out there. Would you agree with that? There is that acknowledgement. But as far as dealing with it, the first step is acknowledgement. Maybe the next step will be dealing with that issue. At least from what I've read and what I've followed, I don't know if Levina would want to comment on that.
Well, I just wanted to add, in addition to what Newell has said, that I think it is helpful to admit that there is a problem. But the question is, why is a divorced person a problem? A divorced person has problems, and a divorced person usually needs support and help. But why is a divorce a problem? And even there's something so patronizing in saying, we acknowledge your problems. And I think that maybe that's where we have to start, but I think we need to get to the root of it before, because the message is that we will help you, but you don't really have very much that you can help us with.
that's a tough question to answer. I would say that the phenomenon of what Deborah Lake went through, she's careful, and I didn't bring this out in my paper, to point out that the phenomenon of what she went through in terms of her crisis of faith, I guess that's what you're referring to, her crisis of faith, is that what you're referring to, and losing that faith? Yeah, I think you can view her situation as you know, a loss of faith, but also a woman who feels that she's being suppressed and submerged in a patriarchal society. You know, I didn't deal with that much in my book, and that's another layer. And, you know, talking about layers of the book, I think that's one another important layer. What she talks about, she feels very much restrained by the patriarchal arrangement, the power arrangement within the church itself. And I think that's a sub theme that deserves. And that's not unique to Mormonism by any instance either. Yes, go ahead. Yeah.
I think what the gentleman back there was trying to articulate is the notion that if you grow up in the church, you do all the things that you're supposed to do in the church, you're married to the temple, everything is going to be all right.
Yeah.
It does not happen that way in all instances. And in fact, in many instances, it is not. And what can be done to help to prevent that sort of a happening?
Well, I think, you know, she addresses that, her naivety. She had this idealistic that everything was going to be all right. And I think that Deborah Lake's book performs an important service in that her you know, her own rite of passage, her own development, becoming aware of this awakening, not just sexually, but awakening that she was very naive and foolish. You know, this young foolish girl who thought that would be that way. We're all more naive and foolish when we're younger, and we become aware that things aren't perfect. I think she had unrealistic expectations that we all do when we're younger. I think you get older, and I found as I've gotten older, I become the gentleman back there. One question.
I think it's so that you not acknowledge that.
Yeah, I would say that you know, that would be true with any organization. I think it's unique to Mormonism that you know, you have these unrealistic, maybe naive, maybe simplistic expectations about how things are going to turn out. I think part of maturity, part of personal growth, is becoming aware that it's not that simple. It's not going to all turn out that perfect in the end, or even along the way. Okay, I guess that's it, huh? I guess thank you very much for your interest.